By way of a quick review, I mentioned that there were, I saw several indications as we looked in the 10th chapter of Daniel at a particular type of demonic entity, a principality. We saw how the prince of Persia was at one time dominant over God's people, the people of Israel and Judah. But then, in the sovereignty of God, and we must never lose sight of the fact, if we lose sight of the sovereignty of God, then we find ourselves given over to a spirit of fear. And that's not what God wants you to have. But we need to be aware of what we're up against. But in the providence of God, in the sovereignty of God, the spirit of Persia began to wane and the spirit of Greece began to wax. We need to understand that if we have a biblical view of history, history is not simply due to this fortuitous circumstance or this fortuitous circumstance or this great person or that great person. It is due to the fact that the world itself is a fallen world and under the judgment of God. And because it is such a world as that, the world has come under the lordship and the dominion of Satan to some degree. And I want to underscore that, to some degree. That's why Satan is called the god of this world. He's the prince of the power of the air. And so the unfolding of human events is not due to bright people, but it's due to God in His sovereignty having sovereignly permitted the evil one to exercise a certain measure of control. Let me illustrate it with three revolutions for a moment before I shift into where we are. And this, I didn't cover this morning, but it helps to kind of flesh out things before we move on. There are three great revolutions when I think about modern times and contrast things. Let's think first of all of the American Revolution. The American Revolution is unique in that there were huge numbers of Bible-believing Christians involved in the American Revolution. And therefore, there was never an absolute contempt for authority. It wasn't simply individual radicals running out here with violence to destroy civilization. The American Revolution begins through lawfully elected representatives coming together and deciding, like the Continental Congress, that they are going to distance themselves from the authority of Great Britain. Whether the American Revolution or War for Independence is right or wrong, it was not a chaotic revolution as such. In many ways, it's a mistake to call the War of Independence a revolution because it's one set of authorities, government authorities, lawful authorities, waging war against another group. But I want to contrast that with the French Revolution. And the French Revolution, like the Russian one, begins somewhat mildly, but then gets in the hands of crazy people. And the French Revolution ends up being a bloodbath. And out of that bloodbath, there comes a single man who eventually seizes power, and that's Napoleon Bonaparte. In other words, it's the bloodiness of the Reign of Terror with people like Robespierre that paves the way for an Antichrist, not the Antichrist, an Antichrist by the name of Napoleon, who rises out of this. And in the French Revolution, very different from the American Revolution, they are radically different things in history. And we must never forget that, even though a lot of people would like to blur it. They're radically different. The American Revolution did not overthrow any basic social structure, religious structure, cultural structure in America. But the French Revolution overthrew all of that and for example, takes a prostitute, puts her on a throne, and marches her in to Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, France, as the embodiment of reason. So you see, in the French Revolution, there's a truly radical thing that overthrows all that's decent and good and whatnot, and it paves the way that out of the chaos and the bloodbath of the Reign of Terror comes a Napoleon who does such damage in Europe. Then let's look at the Russian Revolution, another example of a revolution radically different than the American War for Independence. And in the Russian Revolution, under the most profoundly autocratic rule in all of Europe, the Tsars, you have a movement because of the weakness of Tsar Nicholas II, the last of the Romanovs, you have at the beginning of a revolution through the Mensheviks. The leader of the Mensheviks, who becomes head of the state for a brief period of time in 1917, Kerensky, eventually immigrates to America. But there's a very moderate revolution, not unlike the spirit of the American Revolution. But what happens is, because of the differences in the Eastern and Western calendar, it's called the Octoberist Revolution, but it's really November 17th. What happens is a group of radical, God-hating, immoral, chaos-breathing men and women seize power. They seize the battleship Aurora, and they force the surrender of the Mensheviks, and they seize power, and that's the Bolsheviks. And they're bloody people. They rule with a reign of terror. They are cruel. And they suppress the Russian people for decades. And so what I want to say is that how did these things happen? Why was the American Revolution different from the French and different from the Russian? I submit to you the American Revolution is different than the other two because the spirit in America was different than that was ruling over France and ruling over Russia. Now, I want to make this point that I made this morning. I want to reiterate it and make it much more clearly. Christianity and the church should not be confused with Christendom. Christendom is simply what? It's the Roman Empire influenced by Christianity. It's not perfect. It's not always good. But in my view, of all of the forms of government or ways of life, that's better than forms of government because Christendom has had monarchies and republics and lots of other things. But of all of the ways of life that this world has known throughout its history, Christendom has produced the best, and particularly Christendom in the wake of the Reformation, because in the Reformation, there's this great sense of the right of every man and woman to pick up the Bible and read it and understand it for himself and herself. And out of that comes a sense of self-government and accountability that profoundly affected governments. Without the Reformation, there would have been no United States. Then I want to say one last thing on that before I pick it up into the modern world. Democracy as we know it, call it whatever you will. By democracy, I'm not even referring to a form of government. I'm referring more to a sense of human rights and a way of approaching life, that things like trial by jury, limited government, representative government. That didn't just happen in history. It's the result of historical processes that God was intimately involved in. And if you want to look at where America came from in terms of its basic way of life, in terms of government and rights, we go back to the field at Runnymede in England when the barons forced King John in 1215, I believe it is, to sign the Magna Carta. What's significant about the Magna Carta? The significance of the Magna Carta lies in one basic principle: limitation of government. Limitation of government. The concept of limited government, as over against the kind of thing with the Romanovs in Russia of autocracy and absolute authority. So we have limited government as far back as 1215 when King John is forced to sign the Magna Carta. That really comes to a head in what's called the Second Reformation. In the Second Reformation, the First Reformation occurs in the 16th century with people like Luther and Calvin and Huss and Zwingli and Knox. But the Second Reformation is what occurs in Scotland and England in the following century, the 17th century. In that century, there is a book that you need to know about, and it's called Lex Rex. And the author of that book was a Presbyterian preacher by the name of Samuel Rutherford. Lex Rex, it's Latin, it means law is king. And this is a fundamental defining document that paves the way for what we have in America. The law is king. And by that, again, we're saying that what? Going back to the principles of the Magna Carta, limited government, there are checks and balances. There's a basic sense of realizing human beings are depraved, and because of human depravity, human selfishness, and the tendency that we all have to go nuts eventually, No one is given absolute authority. There are checks and balances, and there are documents that are difficult to change and amend that hold government's power in check. I'm submitting to you that a biblical understanding of these things is to say that they are not only the result of God's sovereignty, but they're also the result, if we really reflect on what's being set forth in that pulling back of the veil of Daniel 10, they're conflicts, or rather we should say they're various ruling spirits or principalities that rise in dominance and fall in dominance. And so what we have in America didn't just happen because people were creative. It's a result of historical process that involves principalities and powers and high places under the overarching sovereignty of God. Now in the West, there's been a basic optimism even in times of pessimism. Now let me say what I mean. A basic optimism even in times of pessimism. And by that is a sense of our way of thinking is right. Our way of thinking is right. The values that we hold to are right. The way that Mama and Daddy brought us up is right. The teachings of the church are right. What we learn from our neighbors is right. Our way of life is right. Now, what have we seen happen in Europe in the 20th century? After World War I, the ruling spirit in Europe, as I have been given to see this, and I'm not purporting to have any unique insight or special revelation. I'm simply looking at history in light of the teaching of Daniel 10. That's all I'm doing. I'm looking at history in the light of Daniel 10. So in looking at history in the light of Daniel 10, what happens in Europe in the wake of World War I is a profound pessimism comes over Europe. Why? Before World War I, almost the entirety of Europe is ruled by fairly benevolent monarchies, many of them constitutionally limited. And there are beginnings of a basic enlightened sense of human rights and welfare, the protection of citizens, and some limitations on the power of government, but still with a monarch at the top in one way or another. As in Great Britain, it's roughly symbolic and not absolute at all. After what happened in the Second Reformation, and in the Second Reformation, you have civil war in Great Britain in the 1700s, and the king is actually executed out of the principles of Lex Rex, the law is king. The king is actually executed and he's put on trial for treason and executed for treason in England in the 17th century. And so again, this limitation on government. What happens is that Europe, after World War I, buys into pessimism big time. And it essentially rejects Christianity as the defining motif of its approach to life. In other words, World War I in Europe is the beginning of the end of Christendom. World War I in Europe is the beginning of the end of Christendom in Europe. Christian values begin to diminish in their influence. And what happens in the wake of that? Well, it's easy to see. Just as the French Revolution gave us Robespierre and other people, and eventually Napoleon, so what happens in the wake of the collapse of Christian values in Europe, give us people like Mussolini and Adolf Hitler. And just as the Russian Revolution that begins with maybe noble ideas, but stupid ideas, failing to take into account human depravity, they give us Lenin and then his successor, who's even more of a monster, Stalin. So Europe then goes into a period of pessimism and a rejection of Christianity. Now, I spoke this morning in terms of evidence of this pessimism as a declining birth rate. And there are wonderful exceptions to that, even in America. There are lots of Christians that have lots of kids. So I'm not saying that the pessimism is absolute and totally pervasive, but taken as a whole, Europe represents a dying civilization. It really does. Europe represents a dying civilization, a kind of jaded, effete, dying civilization. because it's lost its sense of Christian identity, and that's what gave such an impetus to it at the time. What do we see happening in the United States? Well, as I look at the United States, I see the United States as always, ever since World War I, being influenced by Europe, but always maybe a generation behind. So instead of World War I producing pessimism in the United States, that doesn't come even after World War II. The pessimism begins to come in the decade of the 60s. Because in the decade of the 60s, there's a throwing off of the basic standards of Christian civilization. And there's an embracing of relativism. And in the embracing of that relativism, there is a rejection of a sovereign God who's given moral absolutes. And in the wake of that, there's a kind of pessimism. And if you think about it this way, think about each generation of Americans going back to Jamestown and Plymouth Rock, thinking again of the British influence on America as over against the Spanish influence on America or the French. Think of each succeeding generation of Americans going back to the 1600s. What do you find? What were the things that marked the people that came to this country, settled in New England, Virginia, South Carolina, Maryland? What was it? There was a basic optimism about life. There was a basic sense that I don't count, but my children do. My grandchildren really do. And my great-grandchildren really, really do. In other words, there was a basic belief in the future, in this world, and there was a basic sense of self-sacrifice for the welfare of a generation yet to come. And so those early Americans in the 17th and the 18th and the 19th and early 20th centuries, and our icebox is suddenly beginning to heat up. We may need to turn it on for a minute. What happens is that a basic picture of a culture's confidence in itself and its way of life in the future can be measured statistically by its birth rates. When people despair of the future, when people have nihilistic values, people tend not to reproduce themselves. Europe has ceased to replace itself. And so in order to have a population in Europe, Europe is relying on immigrants. Do you want to know one reason why Europe has not backed us in this second Gulf War? It isn't just because of the oil money out of the UN and Germany and France being involved, and that's certainly a factor. But there's another factor, and it's a huge factor. And that is that just as America relies on cheap labor coming out of Mexico, so Europe is relying on immigrants coming in. And where do those immigrants largely come from? There is a growing and very significant Muslim population in Europe, particularly in places like France. Because Algeria was a French colony and so on, there's an enormous change here. So the first thing that we have to go back as we think about and fleshing out this morning, and which I didn't touch on, in, as we think about the decline of the West, what I submit to you, how I see it in light of Daniel 10, is that there is, just as the Persian prince in Daniel 10 declines before the prince of Greece who rises up, so I see the spirit of Christendom, which has produced so much freedom, capitalism, entrepreneurial spirit, adventure, going out, optimism. I see that spirit dying. I see that spirit waning. I see it waning in Europe, and I see it coming here and waning here. There's pessimism. And for me, the greatest indicator of that is how people are educating children today as we look at our heroes of the past. Instead of looking at Columbus as a hero, he's seen as a villain. Instead of seeing George Washington as a great man, and he certainly was a great man, but like all humans, except for the Lord Jesus, he was a man with great flaws, as you have great flaws and so do I. But instead of seeing him as a role model, someone to emulate, we have a tendency in the post-1960s America, we have a tendency to demonize people like George Washington or Thomas Jefferson. Now, Thomas Jefferson was a Christian in the sense that liberal Protestant denominations are Christians. But he wasn't a Christian in the sense of being a Bible-believing man with an evangelical faith in Christ. But nevertheless, Thomas Jefferson really did put into practice in his way of thinking, or put into writing, basic biblical concepts of limited government. But, you know, it's very popular to demonize him. For example, the DNA and all with Sally Henning. Perhaps he had children by her. We don't know. The DNA is conclusive that there's some family ties here, but it may have been a brother of Jefferson. The point I want to make is this. Not that Jefferson sold his own kids into slavery. I don't know that, and I'm not presenting that as having happened. All I'm saying is it's become popular to debunk our heroes, and it's become popular to look at our own history and denigrate it and despise it. So as I say, Christendom is not identical to Christianity. It's not identical to the church. It's imperfect. It has flaws. There are moral failures. There are great exceptions to being good. There are atrocities that have been done. We didn't always treat Native Americans the way they ought to have been treated. We didn't always treat blacks the way they should have been treated, obviously. Slavery was a great blight on our history and our way of life. But these flaws do not remove the fact, and this is what's fundamental for us, that the American way of life is absolutely, as I look at history, the best way of life that human beings have ever come up with. It is. I mean, look at anything else and throw it up against it, and it dims in comparison. So to denigrate George Washington and Thomas Jefferson as evil and wicked men because they did have slaves, and to treat them as if they were no better than Attila the Hun or Genghis Khan, that's wrong and that's evil. They were great men, and God used them, whether they were truly born again and are in heaven or not. They were truly great men, used of God to establish a civilization that is superior. But you see, that very statement is challenged today. I made the statement just a moment ago that the American civilization is superior to other civilizations. That doesn't mean that I think that we ought to conquer the world and make it like us. It's just that when I compare it with other civilizations, I see no other civilization, in spite of our flaws, that has given more opportunity for the gospel, for people to live Christianly, for people to have a good way of life, to have success in life, to create wealth, and to share that wealth and to be kind to others. And I challenge anyone anywhere to give me a better civilization. And again, it's flawed, it's imperfect. But it's, what I'm saying is that one indicator of the waning of the spirit of the West, of the dying of the principality over Christendom, if you will, is the fact that we no longer are comfortable saying that. There are a lot of places, if I said that the American way of life is superior to the way of life of the Native Americans who were here before we came to this country, I've just cussed. I've just used foul language. I've just violated things, and I've become a rube and a bumpkin and a racist or a culturalist. But I'm telling you that the very fact that we're uncomfortable saying that is a prime indicator that our culture is dying. Now let's look at Islam by contrast. Islam is not dying. The spirit behind Islam is very much alive and very assertive and very aggressive. Now we need to understand something about Islam in its impetus. I said this morning that Islam, unlike Christianity, whose founder is the Prince of Peace and who taught us to turn the other cheek and who submitted meekly to oppression and allowed himself to be beaten and even crucified wrongly, the founder of Islam is the mirror opposite of Jesus. Muhammad is a warrior. And Muhammad, after he begins to receive his revelations in the cave, begins to try to change things in Mecca, but they won't have anything to do with him. And so he leaves Mecca in the year 622, and he goes to Medina. And his preaching is accepted by the people in Medina. And within about 8 years of that, he returns with an army of 10,000 people. And he seizes Mecca, and he enforces the Islamic way of life and thinking on the people of Mecca, and he dies 2 years later. What happens immediately after that? Muhammad is succeeded by the caliphs. And under the caliphs, there is a tremendous expansion of Islam. How did they do it? Christianity spread very slowly. Christianity spread by word of mouth. Christianity spread as people shared their faith in Jesus Christ and sometimes were willing to die for the faith. But the early Christians, for at least three centuries, were not willing to kill for the faith. They were only willing to die for the faith. And there's an enormous difference in that. Muhammad is willing, starting in 630, to kill for the faith. And the followers of Muhammad since 630 have been willing to kill for the faith. And so a remarkable thing occurs. Islam spreads throughout Western Asia. And within 10 or 20 years, much of Western Asia is seized. And here is what happens. Christians are offered terms of surrender. As long as they will observe the law of Islam, Sharia, this is a very important concept. As long as they will observe the law of Islam, they are allowed to remain Christians. They cannot engage in what the Muslim would regard as idolatry. They have to keep their faith to themselves. They can share it with their children, but they cannot engage in evangelism beyond that their own community. They can evangelize their own Christian community, their own children, grandchildren. They cannot evangelize the world beyond them. People who are Jews are in the same category as Christians. They are allowed to hold to their faith, but there are limitations on it, just as there are for Christians. But both Christians and Jews have to pay a special penalty tax in order to exist under an Islamic state. So does Islam practice religious tolerance? If you want to define religious tolerance as not being able to engage in evangelism, but being allowed to believe as you want to and have a house of worship, as long as it's kind of a private thing and you don't try to share it openly and publicly beyond your own little ghetto, yes, they practice historically religious tolerance for Christians and Jews because they accept the Bible as God's word, but as a corrupted word. What about people who are not Christians and Jews? They are forced to become Muslims. Polytheists are forced to become Muslims. If you look at the Sudan and the slaughters that are going on in the Sudan today, part of that is that they are doing what Muhammad did. They're dealing with animists. Animists who worship spirits in the rocks and the trees and the water and whatnot. They have to give up their ways. They have to give up their religion and become Muslims. And if they refuse to do so, they will be sold into slavery. They will be put to death. So within 100 years of the death of Muhammad, Muhammad dies in 632, and within 100 years of the death of Muhammad, Islam has conquered the entirety of Christendom except for Europe. It's conquered the entirety of Western Asia. It's conquered the entirety of Northern Africa. It's come in and taken Spain, the Iberian Peninsula, and it's moved around as a pincer movement coming up, but stopped by the Byzantine Empire. What happens in 632 in terms of Europe is there's a battle called the Battle of Tours. And at that battle, the Muslim forces are stopped. And so from 732 onward, Europe, it holds the Muslim hordes in check. But the Muslims still control Spain for 700 years till they're driven out by El Cid. And then, of course, as the Spanish kingdoms unite in one kingdom under Isabel and Ferdinand, they're driven out of Spain in the 15th century. In terms of the eastern part of Europe, what happens there with regard to Islam is that there's a continual assault by the armies of Islam against Christendom, particularly the Byzantine Empire. The Byzantine Empire continues on, and I've talked about this on Wednesday night, until 1453. And in 1453, I think it's May 28th, the city of Constantinople falls before the Ottoman Turks. What was the first thing they did when they seized the city of Constantinople? They went into the greatest church in all of Christendom, the Hagia Sophia, and they immediately converted it into a mosque. And so we need to understand something about Islam. Islam is spread by the sword. It would like not to have to spread by the sword, but it will spread itself by the sword. It practices a kind of religious tolerance. But remember that Islam is interested in external conformity to law. Islam is fundamentally about externalism, conformity to law. And so as long as you conform to the law, you're okay. And what is the law in Islam? It is Sharia. So Islam takes over Constantinople. Part of what you have as you look, you know, we've had the trouble in Eastern Europe since the death of Tito. You have all of this conflict. What was the shot that was fired that started World War I? Anyone remember that? What started World War I? Where was he assassinated? Sarajevo, he was, and that's the name that's been in the news a decade ago with the Clinton wars. And so what you have there is what? What's the problem in that part of the world? The problem in that part of the world goes back to 1453. Because once the Turks take Constantinople, the Turks engage in a policy of raping women and leaving children who are of mixed parentage and developing what? Developing groups of Islamic people amongst the Christian communities of Europe. And the Christian communities in that part of the world, what we call Yugoslavia in the past, were both Eastern and Western Christians. That is, they were Western, some of them were Roman Catholic, and others were Eastern Orthodox. But you have this Islamic influence there that's profound. And it took, and we need to understand this, it took, with all of this foment that went on for a couple hundred years, it took a strong man, it took a dictator by the name of Marshal Tito to hold that thing in check. Because if he didn't have a dictator who was a tyrant, he was a Marxist tyrant, Tito actually was, in a certain sense, this is going to sound bad, funny, he was a blessing. Because he kept these people from killing each other off. Because there are this tremendous ethnic rivalries, Roman Catholic, Greek Orthodox, Islamic people. These rivalries were all at each other's throats. And so Tito ruled with an iron boot. And I jumped ahead in history with Tito, who died a couple of decades ago. And that's when all the chaos started over there again. So Islam continually assaults Eastern Europe from the time of the fall of Constantinople in 1453. And it's finally defeated on September the 12th. Interesting date, isn't it? September 11th, September 12th. September 12th, 1683, at the Battle of Vienna. That's when the forces of the Ottoman Turks are turned back and Eastern Europe is saved. So two significant dates. 732, the Battle of Tours, saves Western Europe, and 1683 saves Eastern Europe. The point I want to make is this, and I'm going to read some quotations from the Quran. Islam is spread by the sword. It practices a form of religious toleration, but it's always with a view to dominance. That's a very key word. Islam means what? Submission. And what's the response of someone enforcing that submission? It's dominance. Dominance is a very key thing. This capricious, unknowable, arbitrary God called Allah rules with an iron hand. He dominates. He doesn't win the heart. He dominates. And he enforces his law this way. Let me read you a couple of quotes from the Quran. And this is important. Because it's important to understand that Osama bin Laden represents a true expression of Islam. That Osama bin Laden represents the spirit of Muhammad. Now, there are other representations of that. But it's very important to understand that what Osama bin Laden represents is not something that's foreign to the basic original spirit of Islam. And let me demonstrate. And then I'll get into the clash between secularist Muslims like Abdel Nasser and Ataturk on the one hand and Saddam Hussein, and on the other hand, the more religious non-secularist Muslims like Osama bin Laden. There is that distinction.